Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Madison Tutt. Coming up on The Wire today.
The presence of people like those in Marawi City is not going to be a good thing for Australia being in the Philippines.
Australia has committed two aircraft towards the fight against the ISIL insurgency in the Philippines' southern island of Mindanao. A whole city and a hinterland has been captured by the Islamic extremists. Is this another Iraq in the making? And
Turnbull saying that it shows just what a fool he is. And I'm not being light about that. I'm being very serious. Every day of the year, an Aboriginal site is vandalised.
It's not just the statues that get vandalised, culture can also be put on trial. Sculptures of historical figures in our parks and public places have never had so much attention. Stay tuned for all this and more on The Wire. I'm Madison Tutt and you're listening to The Wire, around Australia on the Community Radio Network. The South Australian opposition leader Stephen Marshall has proposed a shoot-to-kill policy for police officers that will enable them to use of lethal force during terrorist attacks. This policy will be a part of the Liberal Party's campaign in the state election next year. South Australian Police Minister Peter Malinakis has criticised Marshall, telling the ABC that this was a cheap headline grab. Ollie Henderson has the report.
South Australian police may have shoot-to-kill powers in the event of a terrorist attack if the Liberal government win the state election next year. The opposition leader, Steve Marshall, has based the new measures on advice handed down from the Royal Inquiry into the Lynch siege.
Well, we're going to base this legislation on the legislation which has been put in place in New South Wales following the coroner's report into the Lynch Cafe siege. This will provide greater certainty to police officers who are on the front line.
Current South Australian police are restricted from using lethal force unless there is an imminent threat to life.
Well, police are telling us that this actually reduces the pressure on them because it gives them much greater clarity as to when they can use lethal force. Now, what we know is that during the Lint Cafe inquest, the coroner identified some sort of operational uncertainties amongst police officers about the use of lethal force during the siege. The police involved did not believe that they had lawful authority to shoot the perpetrator. Now, we want to provide that clarity. This is exactly and precisely what this legislation is designed to do.
The opposition leader also stresses the need for increased training with the new anti-terrorism measures.
Well, we would like to increase the level of firearms training in South Australia. We would, in fact, double that to make sure that our police officers are prepared for any eventuality. We've been speaking to agencies across the country, we've been speaking to terrorism experts, we've been speaking to police officers, and we believe there is a case for increased firearms training in South Australia. We're going to double the current amount, and we're going to make sure that our police force is given the skills necessary to cope with a changed environment.
South Australian Greens MP Tammy Franks has criticised the proposal, saying that the fear is overstated.
Australians and South Australians have more to fear from domestic violence and violence in their own homes than they do from terror threats. And it is actually a real disappointment to see politicians in a race to the bottom on these issues.
Greens MP Tammy Franks thinks that preventative community building measures should be put in place to combat terrorism.
The increasing fear of terrorism is actually more the problem. Certainly in terms of domestic situations, we're a pretty safe country, and we should be talking acceptance and inclusion and ensuring that we aren't breeding the very exclusion that creates terrorism. Terrorism occurs when people feel that they're hard done by and excluded, and they take action.
According to the government website, the National Terrorism Threat Advisory System, our current threat level is probable, indicating that individuals or groups contain the intent or capacity to conduct a terrorist attack in Australia. David Olney, Associate Lecturer at the University of Adelaide, says that this may just be fear-mongering for political gain.
Political parties have used fear as a means by which to gain power and keep power. It was very successful for John Howard, and I can't see any reason why a state Liberal Party wouldn't essentially copy what federal Liberals did. Something called a shoot-to-kill order makes it seem more extreme. In reality, it's just clarifying an existing police position. So, as usual, the political message is not as nuanced as it should be to inform the population rather than frighten the population.
That was David Olney, Associate Lecturer at the University of Adelaide, finishing that report by Ollie Henderson with production assistance from Bertha Shingung. With Australian aircraft now involved in the fight against insurgents in the southern Philippines, there's a growing threat of radicalised fighters returning from a country very near to our own. The deadly fighting between government forces and jihadists sympathetic to the Islamic State has killed hundreds of people since May, and politicians back home are worried at the prospect of a growing extremist hotspot in our region. Tysa Cusey investigates how this tension in the south of the Philippines, a predominantly Catholic country, came to be.
The ongoing conflict in the southern Philippines has shown no sign of letting up, with the insurgency claiming the lives of over 500 people since its beginning in May.
The fight against terrorism is right here in our region, and it is deeply concerning that we have Daesh-inspired groups in the city of Marawi in our region. And I agree with the Prime Minister, this is a conflict that we must win.
That was Federal Labor Senator Penny Wong speaking on the ABC's AM program this morning. As both sides of politics escalate their rhetoric over the threat of ISIS-aligned fighters returning from a region very close to Australia. I spoke to Aline Anish Guro, a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne and Director of the Press and Information Office at the Mindanao State University in Marawi City, and she says the conflict is much more complex, running through deep ethnic and religious divides. The situation in Marawi is escalating every day, it seems, with obviously terrorists and foreign fighters coming to Marawi. Can you tell me a little bit about the threat that that poses to a country like Australia, which is very close to the region?
The presence of the, of people like those in Marawi City it's not going to be a good thing for Australia being in the Philippines. You are extending your support to my people in Mindanao, and then we have this problem going on in our midst. And whatever help that you are helping through programs like the BEAM, it's being stalled. And the recovery of Mindanao is delayed.
Should policymakers be thinking about an independent Mindanao?
To be honest with you, the people of Mindanao have long been fighting for the right to self-determination. And issues like this terrorism and also some armed revolutionary groups are really part of that struggle for the right to self-determination. And maybe for now, what is really important is for the government to give us a semblance of the kind of rule that we want, and not just, ruling Mindanao from afar. Because we were an independent group of people before colonialism came in. And we have been trying to stand on our own, and for several decades, most of our revolutionary groups have been wanting to get a form of autonomy from the Philippine government. And I think that the sooner that the Philippine government give us what we want, and not necessarily independence, it is going to be part of the solution in this kind of conflict that is happening right now.
What do you think the relationship is like right now between the current administration, Rodrigo Duterte's government, and the people of Mindanao?
That's a very good question. And for now, it's a wait and see. You know, during the time of Gloria Macapagal Arroyo and even the time of President Benigno Aquino, we were almost about to ink a peace deal, and then something happened. And now President Rodrigo Duterte said that he wants to recognize that there have been historical injustices done to the Bangsamoro people, and then we have this conflict. So right now, it's really a wait and see or whether there's going to be a final deal that will solve all these decades of unrest and conflict from the southern Philippines.
PhD candidate Ellen Anisha Guru from Mindanao State University, ending that report by Taisok Yuzi. On Saturday, statues of colonial figures such as Captain James Cook and former Sydney Governor Lachlan Macquarie were vandalised with spray paint in Sydney's Hyde Park. The defacing of the statues seems to have sparked a growing divide in how our country's history is represented in public spaces in modern Australia. Miles Holbrook-Walk has the story.
Over the weekend, multiple statues were vandalised in Sydney City. Though the act has been praised by some, many public figures have stated vandalising statues or attempting to erase our past is deeply troubling. Sydney Councillor Jess Scully is a member of the governing Clovermore team and believes that the public space for colonial figures needs to be rethought, but not through acts of vandalism.
So I think what we need is actually a more thoughtful and widespread conversation about Australian identity and how we recognise that in our public life and in our public space. And one-off vandalism is not the way to go.
While against a total removal of taking down the statues, the councillor did think there could be the potential for amendments.
I don't think we're in the business of removing statues from the public realm. I do know that in Melbourne, for example, there have been updates put on statues of Batman, for example, to acknowledge, you know, that the land there wasn't unoccupied when Melbourne was colonised. So sometimes there is room to correct the record, but we wouldn't make those decisions unilaterally. It's something that we would talk to our First Nations people about. It's something we would talk to the broader community about, and then we would reach a decision.
Barry Skates is a professor of history with the Australian National University and also questioned the way such statues could continue to exist in a public space without some change.
I think we face choices about our past. The one choice that I don't think we have is to simply leave these statues as they are in these public spaces, because if we do that, we are actually condoning the statements that they make, the implicit statements and the explicit.
Despite condemning the acts of vandalism to the statues over the weekend, Professor Skates also pointed to the absence of media attention placed to another desecration of an Australian statue.
The Yagan statue, of course, commemorate the leader of an Aboriginal resistance movement in the 1830s in the Swan River District in Perth. There's a terrible kind of irony in the beheading of the statue in that that's exactly what happened to Yagan when he was finally hunted down and killed. The decapitation of that statue is very regrettable. The media did not make a fuss about that, and yet a simple comment, perhaps the claims of the Cook Memorial were offensive, gets such media traction, and I find that very unfortunate.
Uncle Ken Canning is a Bidjara man and an Aboriginal elder and was less sympathetic to keeping a statue of former Governor Lachlan Macquarie in Sydney's Hyde Park.
Certainly would take his statue down, because he was a man who made a proclamation that allowed anybody, he gave free rein, anybody to murder an Aboriginal person. Not only murder, put him in public view. Now, why would you have a statue of a psychopath sitting up there where people can then go around and tell lies about what a humane person.
Canning argues that what is more of an issue is what he describes as the daily vandalism of Aboriginal
land.
Every
day of the year, an Aboriginal site is vandalised. Every day of the year, we have mining companies that destroy sacred sites.
In Canberra, there has been strong condemnation of the occurrence over the weekend, especially from Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, who called the act cowardly. An assertion which activist Hayden Williams, who was arrested at an Australia Day protest this year, firmly rejects. And perhaps his rejection of this assertion speaks to the polarising nature of this issue and the divide over the statue's existence in the public space.
No, I don't think it is cowardly. I think because this is the thing you do when everything else you do isn't listened to. It's not like the Aboriginal justice movement has been sitting on its hands. It's been out there. It's been on the streets. We see that at Invasion Day. We see it in Sydney every other month. There's an Aboriginal justice rally. This isn't happened in a vacuum. It's cowardly for people, including Malcolm Turnbull, who has all the power to right previous wrongs and ongoing wrongs, to do nothing or to turn a blind eye and to try and make this issue about graffiti on a stone, when really what it's about is 229 years of violence at the hands of white people over Aboriginal people.
Hayden Williams ending that report by Miles Holbrook-Walk. Anti-whaling group Sea Shepherd says Japan's use of military-grade technology to track its ships has ended its attempts to stop the Southern Ocean whale hunt. Sea Shepherd founder Paul Watson criticised the Australian government, saying Canberra could have done more to help prevent the Japanese whaling fleet. Beginning their campaign against Japanese whalers in 2005, Sea Shepherd have announced their withdrawal from the Antarctic due to Japan's increased surveillance and technology. The tough decision comes after an extensive 12-year campaign that's seen over 6,000 whales saved.
Well, I think, you know, Sea Shepherd has done more for the whales in the past 40 years than any other organisation on the planet, and risked more than anyone else. But, you know, in our campaigns, we've saved the lives of 6,000 whales. Through pressure resulted in the International Court of Justice case, which found Japan's whaling to be illegal, and contempt of court of the Australian Federal Court. And because of our work, you know, Japan has built a new program, which is double the killing area, and much harder to find them, and lowered their quota to 333 from 1,035 whales, which effectively means even at our best years down there with all of our fleet, we would struggle to save any whales.
Managing Director of Sea Shepherd Australia, Jeff Hansen, says the increased killing area and reduced quota for Japanese whalers is making it near impossible for activists to be successful.
Well, I think it's just looking at the fact that last year we sent two vessels down there and we found it very hard to get on the factory vessel. And what seems to be coming clear is that they know exactly where we are at any given time. We don't have the intel that they do. We don't have the funding that they do. Sea Shepherd is funded by mums and dads and kids emptying out their piggy banks.
Jeff also says that despite strong opposition for whaling from the government, there continues to be no action from Canberra.
Both Labor and Liberal governments have, you know, spoke very strongly in opposition about sending a vessel to oppose whaling by Japan. You know, Greg Hunt's words were, you know, we have blood on the water and a blind eye in Tokyo, while we continue to have, you know, no action from Canberra. And, you know, it shouldn't be left up to a group of volunteers to head down to the bottom of the world and take on the Japanese whaling fleet heavily funded and backed by the government of Japan.
Tasmanian Greens Senator Peter Wish Wilson says the Australian government has let Sea Shepherd do their job for them.
This federal Liberal government went through their 2013 election campaign with a promise to commit resources to the Southern Ocean to send a customs vessel or a naval vessel down to the Southern Ocean to monitor Japanese whaling. They've never lived up to that commitment. Every year, Sea Shepherd have asked for their assistance and their support. We've pushed them to, fulfil their election commitment, but they never have.
However, according to the 1959 Antarctic Treaty, negotiated during the height of the Cold War, Australia agreed to limitations on actively asserting sovereignty against foreign nationals. Professor of International Law at ANU, Donald Rothwell, says the Australian government is compromised by the provisions of the treaty.
Any Australian government needs to be mindful of the fact that it is a party to the Antarctic Treaty and that whilst Australia claims territory over Antarctica and as a result seeks to exercise some control over the waters around the Australian Antarctic Territory, the enforcement of Australian law is really compromised by the provisions of... I've always been mindful of that.
Professor Rothwell also says that Sea Shepherd's withdrawal could open opportunities for international negotiations.
Somewhat ironically, the withdrawal of Sea Shepherd from the Southern Ocean may open up a possible negotiating space because Japan has taken a very strong position to not concede to Sea Shepherd. So the absence of Sea Shepherd from the Southern Ocean may possibly open up a negotiating space whereby countries like Australia and other like-minded countries like New Zealand might now be able to have a dialogue with Japan about whaling issues without this backdrop of Sea Shepherd constantly pressuring Japan to cease its whaling.
Nonetheless, Senator Wish Wilson says they will continue to call on the government for action.
We'd like to see them exert pressure at the highest diplomatic levels, and that's directly between the Prime Minister and the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The Japanese have recently escalated this issue with with legislation that's gone to Parliament. It looks like they're actually upping the ante. So, the Australian government needs to likewise do the same with diplomatic pressure on the Japanese government.
Tasmanian Greens Senator Peter Wish-Wilson ending my report. I'm Madison Tutt and you're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio around Australia. A paper released by the New England Journal of Medicine has found that heart attack survivors given anti-inflammatory injections are less likely to have future heart attacks and cancer. The anti-inflammatory drug, canakinumab, was injected into heart attack survivors over a period of 4 years and resulted in breakthrough results. Whilst revolutionary in its concept, the drug doesn't come cheap. Evangeline Maguire reports.
A quarter of people who suffer a heart attack will suffer another within 5 years. However, a US study has paved the way for a new breakthrough in preventative heart treatment that will decrease the likelihood of future heart attacks. Researchers from Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston underwent a 4-year study to determine whether targeting inflammation with an anti-inflammatory drug will lower the risk of heart attacks and cancer. The CANTOS study involved more than 10,000 heart attack survivors with inflammation. The patients were injected every 3 months with an anti-inflammatory drug called canakinumab, alongside the current cholesterol-reducing drug statin. Andrew McLaughlin, professor of pharmacy at the University of Sydney and Concord Hospital, believes that if anything, the study confirms the medical theory surrounding the link between inflammation and heart attacks.
So this was a bit of a different study because they were studying people not with arthritis or other inflammatory conditions we'd normally think of, but actually people who'd previously had a heart attack. And it lined up a bit of a theory in medicine related to the role of inflammation in people with heart disease and complications of cardiovascular disease to see whether or not in treating people with who'd previously had a heart attack and signs of inflammation, whether or not this treatment could actually improve their response. And as you would see if you read the headline of this paper, it certainly showed that it could reduce cardiovascular risk by reducing inflammation.
The trial found that the use of the canakinumab drug resulted in 25% of people protected from a repeat heart attack, compared to statin at 15%. Professor Gary Jennings, chief medical advisor at the National Heart Foundation, argues that the drug is successful for its ability to specifically target inflammation.
Now, we've had anti-inflammatory drugs, there are lots of them around. They're not as specific in their action as this, and some of the other effects they have countered any beneficial effects they might have in heart disease. But canakinumab was developed to specifically address a narrower target than we've ever looked at before. And at least in the people that have tried out in this study, it seems to have worked.
However, the canakinumab drug doesn't come cheap. And as a result, Professor McLaughlin has concerns over the likelihood of the drug being used alongside statin.
So this particular medicine, I think is unlikely to translate into being a treatment that you'd use alongside a statin. And the reason I say that is that this is a monoclonal antibody that you give every 3 months. Each dose costs about $20,000 Australian. So this is a very expensive monoclonal antibody that's given as an injection just under the skin. We call it a subcutaneous injection. And the cost-benefit of this as a treatment right now is really uncertain.
Despite the results, the likelihood of dying from infections is high. Professor McLaughlin argues that further research is required before using the treatment in Australia.
The downside of using a medicine like this, which modifies your immune response and inflammatory process, is an increased risk of infection. There was quite a number of people who got the treatment group in this study that died from infection, and the overall rate of infection was a bit higher. So people who are older and with diabetes actually seem to be at greater risk. We also need to weigh up the possible harms and benefits for any new treatment. And then we have to figure out, importantly, as you point out, whether it's worth it, whether or not the investment in $20,000 a dose at this stage, you know, is able to prevent or save, you know, costs one in the health system, but also improve, of course, the quality of life.
Professor McLaughlin believes that regardless of medical breakthroughs, other risk factors are just as vital to cardiovascular diseases.
People have all sorts of risk factors, some of which are modifiable, some which are not modifiable. So there are things like our diet and lifestyle, which we can modify. But there's also a genetic component that people carry based on your family history, which might put you at greater risk of heart disease as well. You can certainly start to change that by, you know, excluding all those other factors that you can control, but there are some things you can't control for.
Now, whilst the study confirms that lowering inflammation independent of cholesterol reduces cardiovascular risks, there is still a long way to go before heart attacks are no longer the number one cause of death in Australia.
Evangeline Maguire ending that report. That's it for The Wire today. The Wire is a team effort by Radio 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. I'm Madison Tutt. Thanks for your company.
Let's enjoy new stuff, old stuff, a real variety.
My pleasure.
And yay!
2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
I too been a fool.